start with, hi, welcome to Human Development Family Study 5. Human Development. That's what it says up there. Now I'll show you.
Okay. So at least it works for the first minute. I'll check the recording and see if it's adequate. I was having a computer problem when I compressed it, and I had checked it all the way through, and it worked. I didn't listen to the whole thing. I checked it randomly through, and it worked. Stop. Okay. So anyway, for those of you who just joined, if you want to hear maybe what I said, it's on the website for the course. If you have any questions about the syllabus, ask Julie or ask me, and we'll try to take care of them. Some leftovers from Monday. One is that I will try to give you opportunity at the beginning of each class to ask questions. So, are there any questions about the syllabus or anything that I said on Monday? And this may be what happens all semester, that you don't have any questions, but feel free to bring questions. Also, you might email me between classes, and if there are questions that come in to me from you, then I'll share the answers to those as appropriate with the whole class. A couple of other leftovers. One is that I wanted to add to my apologies the fact that I'm probably not going to learn all your names. I'll try, but I would like for you to learn each other's names, at least the people sitting near you. So work on that. Introduce yourself to people. They're really nice people in this class, and they would like to meet you. So test that out. I also forgot to ask who is here, so let me do that. How many of you are in your very first week of courses at UVM? Welcome to UVM. Those of you who are old veterans, look around for those people who are here the first time and offer assistance and guidance. Okay, make them feel welcome. We will do that too, but not as personally as many of you can. How many of you are Human Development and Family Studies majors? Hi, how many of you are first-year students? I'm your advisor. Wanted to get that formality out of the way. I will learn your names, but not in the context of this class. How many of you are Human Development and Family Studies concentrators? Welcome. Minors. Okay. Nursing students. Mm-hmm. Elementary education. Secondary education. Physical education. Art education. Early childhood, sociology, anthropology, psychology, business. What did I miss? What else?
Social work.
Engineering. What else? Nutrition, CDAE, Family and Consumer Science Education. I didn't know that. Okay, good. Okay, if I skipped you, it's not because we don't think you're important. It's because you didn't yell out what I was missing. How many of you are from Vermont? How many of you are from away? How many of you are true flatlanders? Live in a state without mountains. True flatlanders. Okay. How many of you are from my part of Illinois? Where? Oh, well, that's not Illinois. That's Chicago. There's a difference. Anybody else from Illinois? Well, okay, at least we... close enough, I guess. I grew up in southern Illinois, about 300 miles from Chicago. We have a different accent down there. We speak differently, and we think differently than you do, and I spent years trying to get over talking like that. But when I go visit my relatives in Arkansas, it takes me about 30 seconds to fall back into it. New Jersey, Massachusetts, New York, New Hampshire, maniacs, Canadians. One, two, three. I can't see terribly well up there, so. California, Hawaii, some state that has just been washed away by Hurricane Katrina. Any from the Gulf region? Some of you, I'm going to turn serious for a minute, some of you may have friends or relatives in the areas that are currently underwater, and I just wanted to remind you that if you're worried about them and if it starts to bother you, the counseling center is available to offer support, and if you're having trouble getting in touch with people, the local office of the Red Cross will help with that, but try through the university first. We're trying to make it possible for people to get in touch with relatives as quickly as possible. But it's extremely difficult to communicate. And the clear message is that not being able to get in touch is not necessarily indication that really bad things have happened. Really bad things have happened, but it's not necessarily the case that you need to really get worried if you can't get in touch with somebody. I overheard a conversation this morning from between two people. One of them was saying, you're taking your daughter to college, I understand. And she said, well, I was. She was entering as a freshman at Tulane next week, but Tulane is currently underwater, so they are not having classes next week, along with a lot of other problems. Let's see, what else did I skip? Oh, I wanted to remind you yet again, and those of you who just joined, I wanted to remind you once again, the final exam in this course is on Friday, December 16th at noon. So make sure whoever is making your reservations knows that you cannot be out of Burlington before 4 or 5 o'clock. So don't let them make a plane reservation for 1 o'clock on Friday because you won't make the plane. Okay. We will not, cannot give the exam early. Them's the rules. I don't make them. I just suffer. No, the final is at noon and should be, most of you will be finished by 2. Some of you probably not till 3. But you should be able to, if you're already packed and ready to go, you should be able to get to the airport by 3 or 4 easily. I will have another plane right after that. Yeah. No, you will get to your 4 o'clock exam. You have an exam at 4 on the last day? How many of you have? Which course? What course? Math. Okay. They're worse than we are. Two other things. Advice on doing well. One is to think about joining a study group. I mentioned that in the syllabus, but I wanted to emphasize that. It is very clear that people who study with other students, seriously study with other students, not join a study group to hit on other students or to socialize, but people who actually review notes with each other, and review the text and go over their exams after they take the first one and all of those sorts of things, those people learn more and do better. So, duh. I mean, you know, so do it. You might want to find somebody who's in another course that you have, find somebody in your own major, find somebody who's smarter than you are and studies harder. That's always a good ploy. And if you don't know how to go about contacting people, Julie has volunteered to put people in touch with each other. So email her, give her your name, email address, which you'll have when you email her. Give her your major, and she'll try to play matchmaker. Okay. And she won't charge for it. Okay. So think seriously about a study group. If you know you have difficulty with multiple choice exams, if you know you have trouble taking notes, if you know you have trouble reading the text and understanding it, go immediately to the Learning Co-op in the Living Learning Center. Take their workshops on multiple choice exams. Take their workshops on reading the text and study habits. They will help. And the sooner you do it, the sooner it will help. Don't wait until after the second exam to decide you're having difficulty. Okay. So do it. Be proactive. Go for it. They have a website. The website address is in the syllabus, so check that out. They'll have their schedule there. If they don't have things that fit your time, go to Commons in Living Learning. Go into their office and say, "Help, please." And they will. Okay, we were reviewing some of my basic assumptions, one of which was that we can't think about whole people, so we divide them into domains. And we can't think about a whole lifespan, so we divide it into transitions and stages so we can focus on particular parts of it. I drew a matrix on the board to show you how the contents of my mind are organized. It looks sort of like that. And in Unit 1, we're going to be looking at the biological. And we're going to start that in a few minutes. So these are typical transitions: conception, birth, walking, development of motor skills, puberty, parenting, as having children, menopause, recycling. And then the structure of the course is that then we add Unit 2 to that, go back to the beginning, look at the same transitions, and add more transitions, and then look at how they're connected to each other. Okay? Now, in the interest of full disclosure, I also want to tell you a little bit about my biases. Okay. And these are ideas that I think are really important. They are ways of thinking about the material. And at a fundamental level, what I'm trying to do in teaching this course is to encourage you to develop the same perspectives that I have. Okay. It's kind of brainwashing. But you want to psych me out. And the best way to get a good grade is to figure out what the course is about. I'm telling you what it's about, and I will encourage you to develop, or at least use in this course, the same kinds of perspectives that I use. And five of those are... You can't see that, can you? Oh, okay. Now, we're going to try... What I'd like to do, yes, okay, is give you light up there I can do it. Right. And you can see the screen. You can't see if I write on the board, so I won't write on the board. How about that? Okay, that works. Tomorrow I'll figure out how to use my computer. The five viewpoints that are important to me are these, and I'll try to describe and define them a little bit. A developmental perspective means that we assume that people change, and that at any particular point in your life, you are not who you used to be, and you're not who you're going to be. You're in the process of becoming something else. Now, that may seem obvious and trivial, but much of our thinking about human beings and their development does not get informed by a developmental perspective. And many of our human enterprises assume that people come in to them and stay pretty much the same without regard to their development. I encourage you to think of people as always in the process of developing. That's a constant process. And rather than looking at somebody as being really, really odd, or really, really a problem, or really, really stupid, that you think about that person as not having yet developed particular skills or viewpoints that that person needs to develop, or that would help that person to develop. And I'll give you a current example. I'm presently watching a child who is having a great deal of difficulty separating from its mother and accepting being in a setting with strangers. And this kid is actually crying a lot and fussing a lot and refusing to eat and refusing to sleep. And the parents and a couple of other people who are watching this child are really, really concerned that there's something wrong with the child. There's nothing wrong with the child at all. The child is just about a year old. The child is consolidating its attachment to its parent. It has learned the difference between its parent and everybody else in the world, and it is developing its power to make its parent stay with it. And it has learned that if you scream a lot, mommy will come back. It may take 5 or 6 hours, but mommy will come back, and this works. Mommy always comes back. And she is refusing to engage in transactions with other people. And some of the other people are feeling quite rejected. This kid doesn't like me. No. They're not thinking about that child developmentally. This child should be developing a specific attachment to its parents. It should be protesting the parents' departure. The child has never been in care with strangers before, and it is now confronted with several strangers in a strange place. And it is normal, natural, and healthy for this child to reject all those strangers and be fussy and refuse to eat. Not all kids do that, but many do. And instead of being in the kid's face all the time, trying to change it, which is what a couple of the strangers are doing, they're in the kid's face all the time, trying to make it relate to them, which is only making it more upset. What they ought to be doing is saying, okay, we've got to help the kid get comfortable in the setting, so let's give it really engaging things to play with and back off. Get out of the kid's face. Let it explore the environment. Let it get comfortable on its own terms. Let it discover that people aren't going to be in its face all the time, and in fact, they might be really interesting. The people might be really interesting, but let me approach them at my own pace. So what people should do, is, instead of being in the kid's face, is back off, let the kid discover the environment, and then do really interesting things, but not directly with the child. So you attract the child's attention, it starts to get curious, that overcomes its anxiety. It's probably going to take it a week to figure out that mom is always going to come back, so whether it screams or not, so that's okay. And one of the things that the mother is concerned about and the father has expressed concern about is that this kid is going to be shy and fearful and never adapt to any situation that it ever gets into. So they're starting to say things like, well, will he be able to go to school? And my tendency, of course, is to foster that. I say, well, the kid's never going to be able to leave home, ever. That kind of shook him up a little bit. So it's a developmental phenomenon. And if you understand what the kid is doing and think about it developmentally, you know that by next week, the kid is going to own the setting. And it's going to have figured out, by the week after next, how to engage each one of those strangers in activities that are fun. And the kid's going to be fine. It's not going to become less attached to its parent. It's just going to broaden its repertoire. I work a lot with schools, and schools often present to me a case, and the case usually has a name, and when they say the kid's name, people's faces get all distressful, and they want to know how to solve this problem. And there are many different versions of this problem, but one of them is that they have this kid who doesn't do what he's supposed to do or what she's supposed to do. The behavior is upsetting, and this is a problem. They rarely can tell me what the behavior serves in the interest of the kid's development. So that's always my first question. Well, what's this kid wrestling with developmentally? Oh, well, I don't know. They just see a problem. And the next thing they do when they think non-developmentally is that they do think contextually, they blame the problem on the parents. If the parents were doing what they should do, the kid wouldn't have the problem. They're often describing a kid who is having difficulty in an academic area because of a learning disability. They're often describing a kid who's going through puberty. Nobody likes pubescent kids. Not their parents, not teachers, not their peers, not themselves. That's just developmentally normal, you know. You go through puberty, you feel like crud and think everybody hates you, so you behave badly, and you get over it. And that's normal. Okay, I'm not going to beat that horse to death, but the point is that people are always changing, and it helps you to relate to them if you think about how you can help their development rather than see them as a problem that you need to get rid of or worry about forever. There are problems you need to worry about, but most of what we do as human beings is part of our development rather than a problem. The second perspective that I bring to the world is that I am a dyed-in-the-wool constructivist. The constructivist viewpoint is pretty standard in our understanding of learning and development now, but we still need to think about it. And a constructivist viewpoint is one that asserts that we are very active organisms. Human beings are designed to come into the world with brains that gather information and put it together and process it. And in the activities that we do and in the information that we gather, in that process, we are constructing understanding of our experience. And all of our understanding is based on our experience, and it is what we have constructed. We don't get born knowing anything. We get born doing things. And from the doing, we construct our understanding and our awareness of our experience. That's what people are designed to do. And we do it very, very well. But if I understand something, I understand it on the basis of the experience that I have had with it. And we're going to apply a constructivist perspective through the whole course. And we'll keep coming back to that. Transactional, what does that mean? Transactional as a perspective means that I assume that we are always engaged in transactions with each other and with the environment. And that is important because we often act as if people come as packages and behave as they do regardless of the environments that they are in or the relationships that they're in. But I don't believe that. I believe that we are constantly influenced by the environments that we are in and the relationships that we are engaged in. And that our development reflects the opportunities and the experiences that we have had and the relationships that we have engaged in with other people. That goes very nicely with the constructivist viewpoint. The transactional viewpoint I use in two ways. One is that I always think about people relating to the environments or contexts that they're in and changing that context and being changed by it. So it refers to the relationship between the person and the environment. Both are affecting the other simultaneously. The second way in which I use the notion of transaction is to describe relationships. Relationships are what happens between two people when they are both engaged in acting in each other's presence or in regard to each other. And a transactional view of relationships is harder to keep in mind than looking at each person individually, but is more helpful in trying to understand how a relationship develops and why it may have problems, or why it doesn't have problems, why it goes along very well. Okay. Let me elaborate on that point, but I need to use the blackboard to do that. What is a transaction? Basic point. You know what an action is, okay? Somebody does something, that's an action. So I write on the board, that's an action. If I write on Julie, that's an action. What would you do if I wrote on you? She'd be upset. You would have a reaction. And your reaction would be upset. So there's an action, and then Julie would react. Then what would you do? Laugh? Okay, remember I'm using permanent purple magic marker. Okay, I'm going to write your name backward across your forehead so anybody looking in the rearview mirror will know who you are. Okay, action. Reaction, which is what happens when the other person responds to the action that you've had. When you put those two together, you can describe it as an interaction. Action, reaction, further reaction makes for an interaction. Something is going on now between these two people. Okay? You with me? Transaction is a word that we reserve for interactions that change one or both of us. It's a transaction when there is some change. Simple example. I walk into a store. That's an action. Sales associate, right? They're vice presidents now, typically, or assistant vice presidents. Sales assistant comes in and says, "May I help you?" That's a reaction. We begin to have an interaction. I say, "Yes, I'm looking for a purple jumpsuit with yellow stripes, size 42, regular." After he has his internal reaction of, he says, "I don't believe we have any, but I'll go look." "No, we don't. I do have some other things that might be appropriate." And I say, "No, I'm looking for a purple jumpsuit with yellow stripes." He says, "Sorry, can't help you." I leave. We have had an interaction. Neither of us is changed. I don't have a suit. He does have a story to tell when he goes home. Okay. So maybe there's a little bit of a change there. I go to the next store, I ask the same question, we have the same interaction, except that sales assistant says, "Yeah, I've got two or three of them here. What shade of purple do you want?" I try them on, I pick the one that's brightest. When you're over 50, you can wear really bright purple and it's good for you. Nobody cares what you look like after you're 60 or 70. So I hand over my credit card. We do that transaction. That's what it's called, right? A transaction. Okay? So we have a transaction, which means that he's got my money, or at least the charge slip that will give the store owner money. I have the suit. We have both been changed. Okay, that's why it's called a transaction. We have both been changed. So think about that example, not the purple jumpsuit with the stripes, but the fact that we have both been changed. Why is that important? It's because we tend not to think transactionally in some of our trying to understand children or adolescents or relationships. And when we don't think transactionally, one of the things that happens is that we see children behaving in particular ways and say, "Well, their parents have caused that." The parent acted in particular ways with the child. The child's reaction is to develop however quirkily the child developed. And then we stop. And we look at whether or not we can discriminate parents who are going to create that kind of child and parents who aren't, and try to teach them to behave appropriately. A transactional view says the parent's behavior is probably in part a response to the child. The child is creating the parent as much as the parent is creating the child. Parents don't just behave. They behave in transaction with particular children. They behave differently with boys than with girls. They behave differently with children who are easy than they do with children who are fussy and difficult. They behave differently with children who behave in ways that the parent likes. They behave differently with the children that they think are most like themselves than they do with the children who are most like their spouses. So people behave differently depending on who the child is, and that is a transaction in which both the child and the parent engage. And you can't understand the parent-child relationship without thinking of it as a child creating parents who create the child who create the parents, on and on and on. Let me elaborate just one more little bit. If we have two people, A and B, and they are engaged in a relationship, a transactional view says the relationship is not A and it is not B. It is the transaction between them. Now, wrap your mind around that. Your relationship is not you, it's not the other person. It's the transaction between you. It's the actions and reactions and the changes that go on, how you deal with change between you. If you have a transactional view, one of the things you come to understand, and this will help your relationships, is that the problems in your relationship and the joys are not. The joys in the relationship are not because of what you do. And the problems are not because of what the other person does. The joys and the problems are the way you transact with each other. And there's a fundamental problem with relationships. You can't change the other person. The other person is an independent human being, maybe dependent, maybe needy, maybe crying a lot, maybe in your face a lot, but the person is still an independent person in charge of his or her own behavior. You are an independent person in charge of your own behavior. All you get to do is change you and what you put into the transaction. So you can change the transaction, but you can't change the other person, except by changing the transaction and then having the other person develop in response to that transaction. Another side of that, the other side of that coin, is that if there's a problem, you need to look at what you're doing to support the problem and change it. Not blame the other person and say, well, we have this problem because he does this and he needs to change that, or she does this and he needs to change that. No. It's not the other person's fault. It's the transaction. You can talk about what you both do, but you can only change what you do. And so a transactional view, unfortunately, makes us each responsible for our own behavior in relationships particularly. So instead of blaming my kids for all the ways they screwed up, I have to think about, instead of blaming parents for all the ways their kids screwed up, I have to think about, instead of blaming the kids for the way they screwed up, I have to think about the transaction between the parents and the children and how they may have both contributed to the outcome. Okay? Contextual. That's related to a transactional view and to a constructivist view. It simply means that I can't understand anybody independent of their context, the environment that they're in, the environments that they have been in over time. Which is why 60 and 161, the other two courses that I teach, are called the family context of development and the social context of development. Because you have to be able to understand the context that people are transacting with as they're developing. And finally, the applied perspective. I won't spend a lot of time in here talking about abstract theoretical perspectives on development. I won't spend any time at all talking about very minor disputes among researchers and theorists. I'm not going to expect you to become developmental psychologists or PhD human developers. My interest is in how we apply our knowledge to real people. And I teach human development and family studies rather than doing therapy with screwed up kids, which is what I was trained to do. I teach it because I think we can all benefit from having a more sophisticated view of how development happens and how relationships work. So I'm interested in the practicalities of how you are developing, how I'm developing, how we deal with children. I like to work with people who are going to work with people. Therefore, nurses, human development, teachers, all of those of you whose lives are going to be spent trying to help people develop, I'm interested in helping you understand how you might do that. So I will use practical applications as illustrations. I will focus on the parts of the book that deal with the practicalities, the real applications. And I've spent my life, literally, since I was 18, trying to understand how development happens and how to apply that understanding to real situations that people are in. So I will tell lots of stories. One of the wonderful things, I said I love teaching human development because you all are human and you are developing and you can think about it and you're really interested in people, maybe most of you. One of the nice things about teaching human development and family studies is that I get to tell those stories. I mentioned I would tell stories about my friends and my family, but I will also encourage you to think about yourself, your friends, your family, people at different stages, people developing in different ways, and try to understand how the process of development is happening for them. And I will welcome your questions about your own experiences as we go through this. Okay. Let's do it. Let's start Unit 1. In the syllabus, there are focus questions that look sort of like this. I think there may be one or two questions that are different. But what are we looking at when we think about biological development? Okay. First question is, where did you come from? And what did you bring with you? What are genes? What do they do? How do they do it? How do you get from that fertilized one cell, the zygote, to the very, very complex organism that you are? Why do you have a belly button? Oops, sorry. Don't lean on the light switch. I'm sorry. How did you learn to walk? How are boys and girls different? When do they become different? How can you be healthy for a long time? Why does menopause happen? When and why will you die? Why do people die? Why don't we just live forever? And I think this one isn't on the syllabus, but how are transactional and constructivist views represented in physical development? Okay, so that's where we're going in this unit. So let's see what you learned in high school. High school biology. Most of you took it, right? So, where did you come from? What? I know, some of you came from Pennsylvania, and I forgot to ask. That's an old joke about Tommy asks his mother, Tommy's four, he says, "Mommy, where did I come from?" She takes a deep breath, she sits down, goes through the whole birds and bees thing. He says, "Gee, that's really neat, Mommy." Tommy says he came from St. Louis. It's important to think about what the question really is before you spend a lot of time answering it. So where did you come from? It's really difficult to think of yourself as having started as one ovum and one sperm. Maybe. I have difficulty with that. One sperm. Just one. And one ovum. There you are. Boom. Okay. What did you bring with you? Not much. Compared to what you brought when you came back to school. What you brought was a long, long string of DNA. Oy vey. What you brought with you were genes. Where are they? You remember? Remember where you left them? Where are your genes? I know, you're wearing them. G-E-N-E-S. G-E. Where are they? In your brain? Yeah? I'm hearing some other mutterings. Yeah, where do you keep your genes? In the nucleus in your cells. Specifics. The genes are in the nucleus in almost every cell in your body. Almost every cell of your body. There are a couple of exceptions, and those are cells that don't divide. If cells divide, they have genes. If they don't divide, like red blood cells, I think white blood cells don't divide. I don't know. Me neither. Okay. But some of your blood cells don't divide. They just do their thing and die. The stem cells that create them, or the root cells, do divide. That's how they create those blood cells. But the blood cells themselves don't have nuclei. So those trillions and trillions of cells that you have in your body, of all different types, all have genes in the nuclei. And the genes in the nuclei of every one of those cells are identical in most cases. Some of us have specific conditions in which some of the cells don't have the same genes in every case as all the other cells. That's called mosaic. We're kind of strange. What do genes do? Well, where did they come from? I already said that, the sperm and the ovum. What do genes do? They make up your characteristics. How do they do that? They express certain traits. How do they do that? Through a genetic code, which... I'm sorry. They do what? I can't hear. Thank you. They are the formulas for creating enzymes, which are particular kinds of proteins. And the enzymes are what cells do. They create them, they transport them, they transport other substances. The enzymes are the substances within every cell that are what it does. And the genes that are active in that particular cell are the instructions for creating the particular enzymes, and particular enzymes then do particular things. So how do you get from the chemistry within the cell to what color your hair is, or the shape of your nose, or whether or not you have a fiery temperament? Those are examples of gene expression. The gene governs the function of a particular cell or kind of cell, and every cell in your body has the genes, has the instructions for what to do. If your nose is a particular shape, it's because the cells governed by the genes have assembled themselves in a particular way. And that is the shape of your nose. And if you can figure out how a bunch of cells, as they're created, assemble themselves into a particular shape that is known as the Shelton nose. Actually, this is a Stapleton nose. I don't have a Shelton nose. I have a Stapleton nose. If you look carefully from the side, you will see that it is exactly the same as the nose of Queen Elizabeth of England, who is clearly related to my mother, who has the same nose, and actually looks a lot like Queen Elizabeth. I don't know what the Prince Charles was doing, but anyway, here I am. And there she is. If you can figure out how those shapes get constructed by the cells so that you have a Stapleton nose or whatever nose you have, you've got a Nobel Prize going on. But the color of your hair, the texture of your hair, and the wiring of your brain, and the chemistry of your brain, and your body's response to environmental events of all sorts are shaped by the cells that are responding to the genetic instructions. Anything, any characteristic that we say is hereditary or is genetic must be expressed by cellular action. There ain't nothing. There is nothing. Can't do that. I reverted to that Southern Illinois just for a moment there. I caught myself. There is nothing that is hereditary that is not incorporated in and expressed by the behavior of your genes. Whether it's producing particular chemicals in your hair follicles, or the way your somatic cells, the modeling stuff, your nose assemble, or your ears, or when the hair follicles stop functioning. Actually, they function, but what they produce is really defective, so it breaks off immediately. Yeah. Except for three or four. And there are always three or four up there. Kids look at me and say, "Oh, your hair's growing back." No, it's just I have a couple of follicles that haven't quit yet. Okay. They're still happening. Okay. So the fundamental point that I want to really pound is the one that most people don't bring out of high school biology, which is that if something, a trait or a characteristic, is genetic, it must be expressed at the cellular level. Now try to figure that out. How does that happen if what I have is a musical gift and perfect pitch that I got from my parent? I didn't, but if that was your example, how does that get expressed at the cellular level? It's the way your brain functions. Your brain is made up of cells. So when you said your genes are in your brain, indeed they are. Also every other cell in your body. But the way your brain cells are put together and the way the structures of cells respond is the expression of particular genes that lead to a strong tendency to have a higher musical ability than the rest of us. The same is true of any aspect of intelligence or anything else that we say is hereditary. Okay, so those were the questions. I had the answers in my hand. Just to review, where did you come from? A sperm and an ovum. What did you bring with you? Genes. Where are they? Almost every cell of your body. Where did they come from? The sperm and the ovum. What do genes do? They are the formulas for creating enzymes, which is the stuff of cell function. They direct the production and actions of enzymes, and thus the actions of every cell. How do you know your genes are working? I know. You get whistled at when you walk down this. No, that's not. Okay. You know your genes are working because your body works. Your body develops. You have specific characteristics. In other words, your genes are expressed in particular ways. Excuse me while I play with the controls, which... Got it. Okay. Okay, well, technology wins again. What you are supposed to be seeing is a nice DVD about sex. Sorry. And for some reason, I know you don't want to miss it. Okay.
is working toward this. Whether we're thinking about it or not, our body is one make babies. And our bodies are very good at it. Around the world, about 365,000 new babies get made every day. But as ordinary as it seems, creating a new human being is no simple feat. Just think of it.